Good to see a large number back out this evening. Good to have visitors with us as always. We are beginning a series of studies today going through this week. Of course, you're encouraged to attend as many installments as you can. And the overall arc of this series of lessons is emphasizing our place in God's world and what God is communicating to us about the world through His Word, including some physical aspects of the world, including our relationship in the world. Particularly here this evening, we're going to be talking about custody. We're going to be talking about stewardship. And this is a lesson I felt strongly needed to be included in this series. And I wasn't quite sure exactly what direction I wanted to go, because there are a lot of philosophies developed by a lot of people in the modern day regarding humanity and humanity's place in nature. And there are some people who will use the Bible, in fact, to argue for a very active environmentalist type agenda, a very ecologically minded agenda. There's a place for that. We'll probably talk a little bit about that as we go along. There are other people who would not use the Bible for authority if the Bible said that water was wet, and will try to make out like human beings are simply a part of nature and not a special part in any sense of the word, more intelligent than your average rabbit or bear or carrot or whatever, but not necessarily any more gifted, any more special in the mind of whatever kind of design, animate or inanimate, brought these things into creation. And what we're going to do here for a little bit this evening is to emphasize what man's place is in the grand scheme of things, and emphasize the stewardship that God has given to mankind. Human beings were, in the very beginning, given custody of the world. God has entrusted planet Earth to us for a period of however many years it has been, however many years it will be. It is our responsibility to take control and to take custody and to take care of these physical things that we have been given. And in some ways, I think we have done a remarkably good job. And in some ways, I think we've done a remarkably poor job in all of these things. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we go along. We are given a divine mandate, though. From the very beginning, God has exercised His own personal rule over creation. We talked a little bit about that this morning. He is, in fact, the ultimate authority in physical things, the ultimate authority in the physical universe. Any number of passages will do to demonstrate this. Psalm 99, verse 1 will do as well as any of them. The Lord reigns, the text says. Let the peoples tremble. He is enthroned above the cherubim. Let the earth shake. Now, not all the people are going to tremble, of course, but nevertheless, whether they do or do not, the psalmist argues here by inspiration that the God of heaven is the ultimate authority in all of these things. And those human beings under his charge that do not acknowledge that authority are going to be held accountable for that when the time comes for such a thing. But our main point here is the second stage of authority, you might say. God has ultimate authority. He has ultimate rule over the physical world, and some of that rule He has delegated to human beings. Not all parts of that rule by any means, but some of it has been designated to us from the very beginning. Genesis chapter 1, verse number 28, man is given custody of these things, that man was supposed to fill the earth and subdue it. Now, you may have a different definition than I do about what filled means or what subdued means, but I don't think that any of us would argue about the general idea of what God is trying to say here. You are in charge. I've made all of these things. Mankind was the very last thing that He made, human beings. And He told these human beings that all of these other things, everything else that was created, is put in the charge of human beings, that human beings are the designated authorities in this area. And I will argue that the reason that the world looks the way it looks, and I don't mean that in a positive way, I mean in a moral sense, the reason that we have so much trouble out there in the world is because we are doing a poor job of exercising stewardship over the world because of our failures. The text in 2 Corinthians, rather, chapter 4 and verse 4, calls the devil the god of this world. He became the god of this world when we made him the god of this world. Human beings decided from very close to the very beginning, back in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were given a mandate from God. And notice that the mandate that they were given pertains directly to the kind of sin that they committed. They were told specifically to tend the garden. They are in charge of these physical things, in charge of all of these trees. And you're able to eat from any of them except for this one over here. And I don't know if it's significant or not, but that is the very thing that the devil tempted them in. And he got them to accept his rule instead of accepting the rule that God had given them as custodians of the Garden of Eden. And ever since then, to one degree or another, human beings have been doing the same thing. We have been abdicating this rule. God put us in charge, and we are trying as hard as we can, sometimes it seems like, to put the devil in charge. Now, I would like to think that we as the children of God, that Christians, by and large, reject this concept, that we do not want the devil to be our God, that we do not want the devil to be in charge of such things. Fact is, we're outnumbered. And the fact is that we ourselves have our weak moments. We do not always exercise control over such things as we ought to. And, you know, if you ever get into kind of an argument with your agnostic friends or atheist friends or whatever, and they try to use the ugliness of the world, crime and injustice and poverty and all the ugliness that comes with our relationships with human beings, all this stuff that you see on the news these days, and they look at this and they try to argue this as some kind of proof that God is not, in fact, in charge of the world. The proper retort is that you're right. God is not in charge. That's why the world looks like this. And instead of blaming God for failing to get involved, instead of blaming God for not waving his magic wand, as it were, and fixing all these problems, what we ought to be doing is focusing on ourselves, pointing the finger at ourselves and wondering why we haven't fixed this problem. It's not God's problem to fix. It's our problem to fix. We were given charge of these things, and we have fallen down on the job. And the more we exercise this mandate in the name of God, the way that we ought to, the way that he has designed for us to do, the more we're going to find these problems starting to go away. Now, we're never going to be able to completely void the earth of sin. Obviously, not even in our own lives, let alone in the world. And so I'm not trying to sell you some kind of bill of goods here, that if we act like Christians, like we ought to act, and we all one big happy family, then all of a sudden there's not going to be any crime in the world, and there's not going to be any injustice in the world, and there's not going to be any poverty in the world. And I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is this: the reason the world looks like it does morally is because we have not accepted God's rule in our life. And the more we pursue the rule of God, the less the world is going to look like that in our own personal section of it. And perhaps the better we're going to be in position to help other people see the light of Jesus Christ and help them to make the most out of their life and make their little corner of the world maybe make a little bit more sense and maybe be a little bit more moral, a little bit more decent. We have a mandate from God to harvest the world for life's necessities. Now, as is going to be the case, generally speaking, through this week, I'm going to be assuming that the listeners are accepting the Bible as authoritative in such things. Now, that may not be the case. If that's not the case, then we can talk about that. But assuming that we all agree that the Bible is an accurate record of God's will for mankind, we can go to the Bible and see, for instance, in Genesis chapter 1, verse number 28, that God did, in fact, give every plant-bearing seed, every tree-bearing fruit to human beings for our own welfare, so that we would subsist, so that we would be able to survive and thrive in this world. Later on in chapter 9, verse number 3, after the flood, after they disembark from the ark, he has a similar mandate regarding physical meat, regarding animals. Mankind had not been so authorized in previous times. Doesn't mean they didn't do it. Maybe they did. But at this point, certainly, and from this point forward, God has authorized the use of animals for meat. Now, going back to Genesis chapter 4 and Abel, we can argue pretty effectively that mankind had already harnessed animals for other uses, like for wool or for milk perhaps, or maybe even for hides. But at this point, clearly all of animal kind is given to human beings for human beings' use and human beings' welfare, not for abuse. We're going to talk a little bit about abuse as we go along. But there's no question as to where mankind stands in the pecking order, as it may be, as far as the physical things go. Mankind is in charge of these things. Now, that does not mean that we can pursue a stewardship that is based on pride, a stewardship that is based on me first, me only, as it were. There are many passages that we could talk about. I'm going to turn to Job chapter 31. If you have your Old Testaments, you might flip over there with me. And we'll have a little bit of a glimpse here into Job's attitude toward the physical world and how that translates into our relationship with God. Job writes in Job 31 and verse number 24 and following, "If I have put my confidence in gold and called fine gold my trust, if I have gloated because my wealth was great and because my hand had secured so much, if I have looked at the sun when it shone and the moon going in splendor, and my heart became secretly enticed and my hand threw a kiss from my mouth, that too would have been an iniquity calling for judgment, for I would have denied God above." What he's saying here is that an abundance of physical things pursued for nothing more than personal gratification, nothing more than physical personal aggrandizement, is arrogant, and it might as well be idol worship. Worshiping at the idol of self is every bit as bad as throwing these kisses to the hosts of heaven. Worshiping the stars, worshiping the sun, worshiping the moon. It's a denial of God. That's not why God gave us these things. God did not give us these things so that we would be prideful, so that we would be arrogant, nor did he give it to us simply so that we ourselves could be benefited, that we ourselves could be profited and not anybody else. Selfishness is repeatedly and overwhelmingly condemned in the Bible as an attitude that we cannot afford to take. Yes, God has blessed us and blessed us abundantly, but one of the reasons that he has done that is so that we can share with other people. Briefly, we can look at 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse number 17 and following. Instruct those who are rich in this present world. Paul writes here not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. These things are from God here. They're his blessings. Instruct them, verse number 18, to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good fortune for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed. This is not intended for us to simply have a bunch of things. That's not why God gave us plant world. That's not why God gave us the animal world. He gave it so that we would be able to, first of all, serve him, and secondly, serve one another. These are blessings that we can use, if we choose to do so, to glorify him and to pursue his purposes. Now, not everybody's going to do that. But to pursue our own selfish agenda, pursue our own personal goals at the expense of God's goals, this is an abandonment of the mandate God has given us. Part of this mandate is to subjugate the animals also. Very brief mention is made of this in James chapter 3 and verse number 7, where the New American Standard Bible, I believe here, reads that all species of the earth have been tamed and brought under control. And that passage, of course, is talking about taming the tongue. And the use of the word species is kind of unfortunate. The New American Standard reads that way. I bet you your version very well may read the same way. That is, I trust you understand, a scientific word. That is not a Bible word. I'm not objecting to the word necessarily, but it can give the impression that God has put his stamp of approval on our system of lining up how animals are related and which ones are connected to whom and how closely related and all that kind of thing. That is a human explanation for the animal world and for the plant world. That is not God's explanation. Somebody says, well, you know, how about, you know, great white sharks? Nobody's tamed a great white shark, and so therefore James 3 verse 7 is not true. That's not what he's trying to get at here. Other versions, I think the Old King James Version has kinds or similar words there. The idea is that mankind has demonstrated control over the animal world, all aspects of the animal world. We're going to run across this later on in the study when we come across these gigantic animals that existed and don't anymore. And I'm going to argue, at least in part, they were killed by human beings. And people wonder, how in the world could a human being kill this gigantic mastodon or whatever? Well, the fact is they did. And the fact is this is part of the custody that man has over the last few millennia exercised over the animal kingdom. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but I don't believe there are very many exceptions to this. Every animal, certainly every land animal on earth that is larger than a human being has either been domesticated or hunted to near extinction. You know, tigers, alligators, elephants, rhinos, whatever. Mankind, a lot of men died in the process of subjugating these animals. But mankind historically has determined we are not going to be ruled by animals. We are going to rule the animals. And again, not every human being did so with the right kind of attitude, and sometimes we are wasteful in that. But the overall mandate comes from God. God has told us, you are not going to be ruled by animals. You are going to rule the animals. Now, there are some examples, and we're going to talk about Leviathan a little bit more, if I remember right, on Wednesday. And a little bit more about Leviathan later on. Long story behind that, and we'll get to that later. But there is an animal described for us in Job chapter 41 that I'd like to make brief reference to here. An animal that has not been tamed. An animal that does not wear a collar, that does not go by a leash or anything like that. And that's kind of the whole point of this passage, that there are these enormous, monstrous creatures that mankind is having trouble subjugating. We read about how in verse number 1, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? That is to say, can you domesticate this animal? Can you make a pet out of this animal? And the answer clearly is no. Behold, your expectation is false, as he says in verse number 9. Will you even be laid low even at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he dares arouse him. And here's the point of the description, at least part of the point of the description, the middle of verse number 10. Who is he who can stand before me? If you have trouble facing down Leviathan, imagine what it would be like to face down me. He says, who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. Even Leviathan is under my subjugation, God says here. The point being that when we do have difficulty, when we do have challenges in front of us in facing this stewardship, this custody of the world, when it becomes difficult, even painful to do so, we can trust in God. Because whatever difficulty we may have, God's not going to have that difficulty. You know the story in 1 Samuel chapter 17 and verses 34 through 36. Where David, and I don't know exactly how this worked, David just tells us how it happened and we trust him to be telling us the truth, but we're told that David, the relatively young man, while he is out in the sheepfold, killed a lion and killed a bear in the pursuit of the work that his father, his physical father, Jesse, had given him. Now, how exactly did that work? Was it a really old lion? Was it a really young bear? Was David given supernatural strength here somehow? Did he have a really, really sharp knife? I don't know. The text doesn't say. But the implication in the text here is that without God's help, David wouldn't have been able to do this. And with God's help, he could do it. And that's the point that we need to get out of this. As we exercise our mandate, whether it's in regard to animals or plants or whatever else might come along, that when we trust in God, even the challenging things that he has asked us to do, we will be empowered to do. God will not allow us to fail if we trust in him. The fact is, though, we do fail. And we have failed historically, repeatedly failed. We look at the world around us and we, again, as we mentioned before, the very existence of these things is used as an argument against God. How could God possibly exist with all of these things? Injustice. And you know the problems in this world as well as I do. Murderers going free, innocent people being slaughtered, mass shootings in malls and schools and all the rest of this. Why does all this injustice exist? Because God doesn't get involved? No, because we don't get involved. because we avoid accountability for the choices that we make. I oftentimes find myself thinking about Ecclesiastes 5, verse 8, when I read too much on the Drudge Report or watch too much news on the TV or whatever, and think, you know, how in the world could things possibly get any worse in Washington? Well, brace yourselves. Okay, I'm not criticizing this particular government or any particular government. It can get worse. And if you live long enough, I bet you it will get worse. Historically speaking, there has always been problems in government. Solomon says this about his own government in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 8. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight, for one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. The problem that Solomon suffered with in his day is the same problem that we suffer with in our day, that nobody is accountable for anything. The buck doesn't stop anywhere. There is nobody who raises his hand and says, the problem is mine. I did not do this job right. I will do this job better next time. Our system, our society, especially in a 300 million citizen nation, it becomes impossible for anybody, whether it's the president or a congressman or a governor or whoever, it is impossible for a single person to exercise proper control. He has to delegate. And the person that he delegates to is going to delegate to somebody else. And the more layers of bureaucracy, the more layers of accountability that are added on here, the less likely it is that anybody's going to be accountable. And this is the way it always has been. We're not going to wake up tomorrow with some kind of grand idea and walk over to the United Nations and give it to them and say, look, if you do this, then there's not going to be any injustice anymore. And everybody's going to say, that's a great idea. I don't know why we didn't think of that. And we'll start doing that, and all of a sudden there's going to be fairness running rampant all over the world. That's not going to happen. It's never going to happen. I'm not trying to be the source of doom and gloom here, but let's face reality as far as that goes. This is because individual human beings like you and me, we're not talking about presidents and governors and kings, we're talking about human beings. We have chosen not to exercise control over our part of the world and to dodge accountability when we fail to do so. Ugliness abounds because we ignore long-term consequences in pursuit of short-term exploitation. All this grotesque, you know, pollution and waste, and I debated long and hard as to exactly how much I wanted to talk about this here, and I'm not going to talk about it as much as I would like, perhaps, but the fact is we have made a mess of things in a lot of ways, and the reason is we have taken God's word and turned it upside down. We see that our actions may, in fact, have long-term consequences, whether we're talking about ecological consequences or environmental consequences, or whether we're talking about monetary consequences or whatever it happens to be. And we choose to ignore the long-term because it's more convenient for us to enjoy the short-term. And again, I'm not especially talking about government here. I'm talking about human beings. There's a wonderful passage that I was going to focus on, verse number 20 in Proverbs chapter 30, but I'd like to back up a little bit and look at verse number 18. And look at the way that God's world works and how wonderful it is. The proverb writer here, Agur, writes in verse number 18, there are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. And the emphasis there on that last one. When we do things in God's way, when we do things in accordance with God's plan, it's a wonderful thing. It's all sunshine and roses. It's a marvelous, beautiful arrangement. Because we have chosen to accept the long-term responsibility that God has given us instead of being obsessed with the short term. Now, the converse of that is in verse number 20. This is the way, that same way that we've been talking about. He says, this is the way of the adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done no wrong. Now, there are ramifications, obviously, regarding personal conduct in our relationships and dating and that kind of thing. But the overall message was what we want to get at here. This is a woman who is consumed with the short term. And she gets what she wants out of life. And she sees no reason to apologize for it. No matter who it hurts, no matter what kind of long-term consequences happen in her life or in anybody else's life. I have done no wrong. I did what I wanted to do. That's all that I was concerned about. And that kind of attitude results in disaster in the world that surrounds us. Earlier in the chapter, verse number 30, the leech has two daughters. Give, give. The leech, you know, it's all about me. And it's easy to miss the significance of this. The leech doesn't have one daughter. The leech has two daughters. Give and give. If you take a selfish, self-serving attitude toward the world that God has given you, if you think that it's all about you, the next generation is going to be twice as bad. This has a multiplicative impact. We see that working in parents and grandparents and children today. We see it in all kinds of different applications. If we train our young people to think that living in this world is all about getting what you want and as much of it as you can and as quickly as you can and as painlessly as you can, if you think that's all that the world is about, their children are going to be twice as bad. And we cannot afford to go down that road. That is a rejection of God's mandate for our life. And we're going to talk about violence as far as this goes too. Why do we live in a violent society? Why do we live in a culture that seems to almost worship violence? Well, there are all kinds of reasons, and I'm not going to point my finger today at video games or you know, whatever, movies, Hollywood. The ultimate reason why violence is so prevalent in our society is because we don't love our neighbor as ourselves. That's the problem. God's way works. When we do things God's way, we don't have these kind of problems. But we insist on not doing things God's way, and we get ourselves in a mess. Going back to Leviticus 19, verse 18, where the commandment is originally given. And back up a verse, to verse number 17. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor. You know, pointing your finger saying you're not doing right. You can do that, he says. But you shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. That punctuation that he puts on so many of these commandments in Leviticus is significant here. I am in charge. And if you are going to be my custodians, if you're going to be my representatives, you're going to conduct yourself in the way that I tell you to. And he says that love should characterize our relationship with our neighbor. We should not be looking for excuses to be belligerent or angry or even violent against our neighbor. We should not be rationalizing that kind of behavior on our own part. We should be loving our neighbor as ourselves. And if we lived in a culture, I propose to you, where everybody loved his neighbor as himself, we'd have a pretty loving culture. If we lived in a world where everybody loved their neighbor as themselves, we'd all be one big happy family. The reason that it doesn't look like that is because we're not doing this. Because we are not loving our neighbor as ourselves. Depravity, sin, ungodliness is running rampant in our society. And to a certain degree, it always has. I'm not just totally upset at the 21st century here. It's been this way for a long, long time. Other societies may have been better, may have been worse, whatever. But it's always been this way. The reason that it is because we insist on rewarding people for sinful choices. And I see this working in our society, and I turn over to Isaiah chapter 5, and I read this text, and I think this is talking about me. This is talking about my world. This isn't Isaiah's world. It's talking about my world as much as it is his. And the verse that we usually focus on is verse number 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. There is an element in our society, a growing element in my judgment, that is insisting on looking at evil things and valuing them because they're evil. Valuing them because they reject God's values. Drunkenness, violence, depravity of all sorts. These are held up as at least morally neutral things. And aren't we a wonderful society that permits this kind of thing? And more, we are seeing that these things are held up as moral goods. You ought to be living this life. There is an evangelism of depravity that is rampant in our society. There are some specifics that are given here. Look at verse number 21. He says, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. That's the problem here. See, we're setting up standards for ourselves. We are deciding what's right and wrong instead of trusting in God for these decisions. Verse 22, woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink. Excessive behavior, not just in alcohol, but in other ways also. You know, people, you know, Charlie Sheen types who are just living life to the fullest, getting the most out of life, going for it, going for the gusto, you know, whatever kind of catchphrase you want to use here. These people, in many quarters anyway, are honored for the lifestyle that they live. And it is exactly the opposite of what God wants out of our lives. And back up to verse number 19 also. Verse 18. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as it with cart ropes. I love that expression there. Allow me to parenthetically insert here. You know, if I can carry 100 pounds of sin on my back, that's not good enough. I'm going to make a wagon. Yep. Because I can put 300 pounds of sin in a wagon, and I can haul that around with me. That's what I want. That's the society that Isaiah's people are living in. That's the society that we're living in. The more, the uglier, the better, he says. These same ones say in verse number 19, let God make speed. Let him hasten his work that we may see it. And let the purpose of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass so that we may know it. The point being here, if God's really upset about this, if God really doesn't want this kind of lifestyle, then God will put a stop to it. And if he doesn't put a stop to it, that's evidence, as far as we're concerned, that he's not upset with it, that it's okay for us to do it, and therefore we're going to do it. Well, sometimes God does put a stop to it. Sometimes God does call down fire from heaven and destroy the wicked ones. Sometimes he does open up the earth and swallow them up. Sometimes he does cast down governments. More on that on Thursday. But not always. Doesn't always work that way, not in the short term anyway. Does that mean that God doesn't care one way or the other? No, it does not mean that. We have to emphasize that God has given us the job of taking care of these things. And we must pursue these things. We must be good stewards of the things that God has given us. So let's talk about that a little bit. God's gifts should be used responsibly. The things that God has given us, and that's, you know, basically everything, the things that he has given us have to be used in the way that God has required for us to do. Gifts or special gifts or spiritual gifts, depending on the way your Bible reads in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 10, are given to us, particularly in that context, given to Christians, in various manners, to varying degrees. But whatever you use, whether it is a gift of prophecy, whether it's a gift of service, whatever you happen to be gifted with, you use it to glorify God. You use it to accomplish his purposes and not to simply accomplish your own purposes. The possessions that you're given here. Jesus tells a story in Matthew chapter 24. Actually, he tells a lot of stories about stewardship, but this one particularly jumps to my mind. In Matthew 24 and verse 45 and following, this man who is given stewardship over his Lord's possessions, and blessed is the one who is judicious in his use of those things. And woe be to the one who doesn't, who says, well, my master's going to be gone a long time. I'm just going to kind of do what I'm going to drink his wine. I'm going to eat his food. I'm going to beat his servants. I'm going to do whatever I feel like doing because that's what I want to do. Well, that person's going to be condemned because his master is going to come when he is not expected. And that servant is going to be held accountable for the choices that he made. That is going to be us one day. And to a very real extent, that is us every day. God sees the way we are managing his things. You know, and I don't want to get too overly picky about this, but lots of times when we take up a collection on Sunday mornings, we'll say something to the effect of, this is our opportunity to give back to God what he has blessed us with. I don't have any serious objection to that terminology, but I think we need to realize that whether it's in my pocket or whether it's in the plate up front here, it's God's money anyway. It's always God's money. The question is, who is going to have charge of it? I am choosing, as God has instructed me to do so, to give money to his work, give it to the custody of the church, and let the church accomplish the church's purposes. But before I do that, while it's in my pocket, it's still God's money. And at that point, I need to be accomplishing God's purposes while I have it. as an individual Christian, as a child of God, I have a responsibility to dispose of his things in a way that honors him and not just that honors me. The gospel may be the most obvious example of this. The gospel is the greatest gift that God ever gave to mankind. And we also have to be useful and proper in our use of it. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse number 4. Paul is talking about these ones who condemn him. And says, well, if other people look down their nose at me, they don't think I'm a very good apostle. Well, I'll get over that, I guess. I'm conscious of nothing against myself, he says. Yet I'm not by this acquitted, but the one who examines me is the Lord. All of us will be held accountable by the Lord for how we conduct ourselves as Christians, as preachers, as apostles, whoever we happen to be. Paul knew that he would give account of the way that he disposed of the gospel. And he had a special calling because he was an apostle. Woe be to me if I preach not the gospel, he says. But to a certain degree, all of us who have the Bible in our hands have that same responsibility. And we also will be asked to give account to God for the way that we use it. And when we use these things that God has given us in a flippant way, a destructive way, a self-serving way, a way that does not accomplish his purposes, that is a self-centered attitude, it is a wasteful attitude, it is an ungrateful attitude. And that goes to every aspect of God's creation that he has put in our custody. There's an odd little story given to us in the book of Jonah that a lot of people have debated about. And perhaps the strangest ending to any book in the Bible is Jonah chapter 4 and verse number 11, where Jonah has basically criticized God, ridiculed God almost, for not destroying the Ninevites when he had a chance. Now, they're a wicked society. You had a chance to destroy them. You didn't do it. You gave them a chance to repent, and they did. And you were merciful to them. How dare you be merciful to these people? And then God has this little experiment with him, with the gourd vine that grows up and shelters Jonah. And he's very, very concerned about the death of his gourd vine. But he doesn't care anything about hundreds of thousands of Ninevites who he wanted dead. And not just the soldiers, an entire society, an entire city, an entire empire that Jonah wanted dead, including, as verse number 11 says, women and children, people who don't know their left hand from their right, and also much cattle. And that kind of jolts at me a little bit. Cattle, where'd that come from? Well, I think the simple explanation is the best. That when we are looking at the things of God as an opportunity to promote our own agenda, to get our own way, to get rid of all the bad guys as we define bad guys, we are asking God to create ripples in the pond that go far beyond anything that we're expecting here. Do you really want children to die? Do you really want non-combatants to die? Do you really want elderly people to die? How about the animals? You got some kind of problem with the animals? This is what Jonah is asking for. And the reason he is so flippant about animal life, about human life, about all of these things, and not about his gourd vine, is because he likes the gourd vine. And he doesn't especially care about all the rest of this stuff. It's a selfish, it's a self-centered kind of attitude. And we absolutely have to avoid that in our life. We cannot afford to think that God has simply given us all these things so that we can have them. Yes, we are supposed to use them. Proper use of God's blessings is not a reckless thing. It is appropriate for us to use the plant world, to use the animal world, to use the physical world in a way that accomplishes our purposes. There are some, and especially his purposes, there are some extreme examples given to us in the scriptures regarding harvesting materials, for instance. First Chronicles, chapter 22 and verse 14 talks about the preparations for the building of the temple. And enormous amounts of material were put together for this task. Gold, silver, stone, wood. You know, you want to talk about strip mining? I don't know if exactly strip mining was involved in this, but certainly there was not any particular concern about whether we're going to hurt the feelings of the earth by digging up all this gold and silver, or cutting down all these trees, or harvesting all this rock. That was not the issue. A greater good was involved here, and mankind was authorized to harvest the earth to accomplish these purposes. The same thing goes for animals. When the temple is finally completed, Solomon authorizes a wholesale slaughter of thousands and thousands of animals. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse number 4, and other examples abound also. Now, what was done with all those animals? Were they just burned to a crisp? Did Solomon have a big barbecue for everybody who was there? I don't know. The text doesn't say. I might have my ideas, you might have yours. The point is, it was acceptable in the eyes of God for animals to die for his purposes. And in this particular instance, for an awful lot of animals. God could have done this without slaughtering the animals. But he chose to allow this because it was within the mandate that he had given mankind for its custody of the world. Now, you can go too far with this. There's no doubt about that. You may have a different definition than I do as far as what too far is, and that's okay. We can have a civilized discussion about that. But the discussion that we cannot afford to have is whether we have a right to take from the earth things that we need in this life, and especially the things that we need to honor God. That mandate is given to us by God. Now, when we are abusing that trust, when we go too far, when we do take a selfish attitude toward these things, that is an insult to our Heavenly Father. That is a thumb in his eye, as it were, as rejecting his mandate. It is not, I must emphasize here, a crime against our mother. And I don't want to get too sidetracked on this, but can we please place a moratorium on the use of this Mother Nature business or Mother Earth business, this personification of nature? It is pagan, it is anti-God, it is an effort to deny the God of heaven. That's where all of these roots are. I'm not saying that every person who uses these phrases is thinking that way. I'm sure they're not. But this is not a crime against earth. Earth is the blessing that God has given to us. The crime comes in when we refuse to accept God's rules for our life, when we refuse to exercise ourselves as God has told us to do so, whether it's in this area or in any other area. God has given us requirements. He has expected us to behave in a certain way. And we've been talking here about our custody of the earth, but the same thing could go for any number of other commandments that God has given us. And our responsibility is to listen to God and allow him to speak to us and for us to respond to him in obedience and faith. Now, if we choose not to do that, if we choose to serve ourselves instead of serving God, if we choose to glorify ourselves in the short term rather than glorifying him in the long term, there will be a reckoning for this. There will be an accounting. God will show everyone, ultimately, in his due time, in his way, who has been a good steward, who has not been a good steward. What we need to do in our lives is make sure that we are the most faithful as we possibly can be in our efforts to dispose of the things that he has given us, up to and including and especially the time that he's given us. I don't know how literally close to 67 you're going to get in this life. You may get less, you may get more. Some of you have already gotten more, and that's great. But however much of it there is of no relevance if we don't spend it the way that God has required us to spend it. So what we need to do is focus on, are we serving God? Are we committed to his task in this area and in every other area? We're going to give you an opportunity to respond to the Lord's invitation as we extend it in just a moment. And the question in front of us is, how seriously do we take our responsibility toward God? Are we living for him, or are we living for himself, for ourselves? If we are living for him, then it needs to show in our activity. It needs to show in our behavior. It needs to show in our choices. It needs to show in our baptism. Jesus says, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. Mark 16, verse 16. If you are willing to commit yourself to God, that means you're going to do what God has asked you, has required you, to do. And if this is where you fall short this evening, we offer you an opportunity to make that right. Whatever your situation is in life, however you're falling short, if you need the help of brothers and sisters in Christ to help you set yourself on the right path toward a proper relationship with God and ultimately a home in heaven, we encourage you to come and respond to the invitation while we stand and sing.